Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Hello and welcome to another edition of En Camino, your Saturday supplement coming to you live on Talk Radio Europe this 4th of July. I'm Kit Hogg and I hope you're well this weekend. At this, the high summer apex of the year, the show is dedicated to the onset of verano and the month of July. With the coast roads choking in traffic, we review the unpredictable and enigmatic behaviour of hire cars on the N340. With a vast recent influx of foreign residential wealth, house prices up 60% in the past 10 years, and an anticipated tsunami of no less than 9 million tourists this year, we look at the changing face of Madrid. On the 90th anniversary of the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War, with the help of some contemporary literary masters, we recall through their eyes the barbarity and madness that engulfed Spain in July of 1936, and having absconded from the broiling Seville summer sun, Coibi sends a postcard from the green north, from Galicia, in just a moment.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Coibs, good morning.
Good morning.
I can't. Hang on a minute. I'm going to put you on loudspeaker. Coibi, good morning.
Good morning.
That's better. How's it going in Galicia?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I was just saying good morning and happy 4th of July to all the American listeners.
Oh, very good, man. Yeah. We're trying to sidestep that, actually. I was thinking about doing a letter from New Jersey this morning, but we're doing a postcard from Galicia instead. And I'm now leaving behind the Andaluz summer. Just how much of a relief is it to be in the green north? How cool and balmy is it?
If you would have asked me a week ago, I would have said an absolutely mesmeric difference. But today we're reaching the peak of 36 degrees, and yesterday was around the same, which is unprecedented for Galicia. All of the Gallegos are up in arms about this heat, and it's unbearable, to be honest. We've got a bit of a heat wave here. So we've got yesterday, day before yesterday, and today are going to be really hot. And then on Monday, thank God, it'll apparently come back down to 24 degrees.
24, right. Okay, so that's quite nice. That's like putting on a jacket in the evening. But there's no reason why you guys shouldn't escape the heat wave. I mean, the temperatures in Wales have been ridiculous. I mean, up in the 30s.
Yeah, I guess there's no easy way out. But they are very used to having a nice temperate climate, especially where we are at the moment. We're in the Rías Baixas, which are these kind of like inlets, massive inlets into land on the northwest of Spain, where there's a kind of microclimate where you get like a nice soft breeze off the sea, plus like the warmth of the bays themselves and these incredible beaches, which at the moment are scorching hot. So we're going down with two parasols, you know, doubling up.
Yeah, so like hot sand, you can't walk on the sand.
No, it's not. It's not that hot. Actually, you can walk in the sand. It's not scalding Andalusia hot, where you have to sprint across the beach. But it is. You know, we were at a thing last night for our birthday party with a friend, and it was very hot. Even at 7 o'clock in the evening, it was hot because here, this is the place where you get the most sunlight in the whole of the country. It doesn't get completely dark until 11 o'clock at night.
Because it's far north. Yes, of course.
Yeah. and it gives you these kind of very long days and very long evenings where you know, the light really does trick you. You know, you'd think it was probably 7 o'clock in the evening, and it's actually getting on for 10.
Yeah.
So you get these kind of beautiful kind of sitting outside type evenings, which just go on forever and ever. And yeah, when it is a good temperature, which is most of the time, we got here 10 days ago, and at the beginning we were wrapping up warm, and I remember even putting some trousers on, which seems like a faint memory at the moment.
Right.
I did put some trousers on for dinner.
Isn't that an odd feeling when you've been used to wearing shorts, you put trousers on, suddenly you feel kind of restricted? It feels quite odd.
I quite like it. I feel like it's like dressing up, like going back to school.
Yeah, you know? Depends on the trousers.
Kind of yeah.
They need to be loose. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So I know you've been forbidden by your wife to give us your exact location for fear that everyone's going to start flocking up there. But you are on the West Coast, am I right?
Are you right? We're on the West Coast, and I'll give you an idea of. Well, I've already given the listeners an idea of where I am. I'm in one of the Rías Baixas, so it's right on the West Coast, and you get a huge amount of coastline because it's kind of cut into the land.
Mm.
And I think there's five different Rías that come up from the south up to the north. So you've got Vigo, and then moving further up, you've got Pontevedra. So these are the big cities, obviously, that kind of dominate these Rías, these inlets. The next one up is Arousa, and then further up from there, then it kind of moves up to the more hardcore and wilder ones. So what we've kind of seen is that the further south ones are more heavily populated with really beautiful big beaches, you know, chiringuitos on the beach, that kind of thing, and actually quite a lot of wealth. And then further up, we're a little bit further up. I won't say exactly where we are, but it kind of gets wilder and more things ready to discover. So we were amazed when we got here 10 days ago, where actually there weren't many people at all, because we were at the end of June, and we were getting down to beaches where there was literally no one, and just these beautiful, beautiful beaches. Like, the water is crystal clear. My wife's been to the Maldives and you know, it's like special places where she goes diving, and she's saying things like she hasn't seen water this clean, like, you know, since that trip.
Wow. Wow.
So yesterday, for example, we found a beach where we had to hike through a forest. We did a 30-minute, 40-minute hike to get down in some blistering heat. And then when we finally got to this beach that was only available during low tide, and you get lots of beaches like that, they get covered up as the tide comes up. So it just kind of adds to the romanticism of it all, that you kind of know it's temporary, you know. And then...
Hang on, what's temporary?
The beaches, because it's only available during low tide.
Yes, because it's super tidal, isn't it? Which we don't have on the Mediterranean. Tidal. We're not used to tides anymore.
But no, exactly.
Of course, you're on the Atlantic.
Explain what a tide is.
Right. Yes. And how weirdly it's connected to the moon. I never really understood that.
I don't understand it either, so I'll skip that question.
I'm not going to answer. I'm going to ask it. Don't worry.
What you get is kind of these, you know, if you arrive in the morning, and we're going in the morning, which seems to be the time when no one else really goes to the beaches. Everyone seems to go apart, like, from 4 o'clock onwards for some reason. I'm not sure why. It's like a Galician thing. But we're going down in the mornings, and you get pristine sands that haven't actually been touched yet because the tide has just gone out. So we're getting low tide in like the mid-morning at the moment, and then it will start coming up, and it will come up quite fast, and then it will take away the beach, and that'll be it. And so especially in the ones that we're going to, which have got these rock pools around the edge of the land, and then yesterday we had a big kelp forest within the bay.
Mm.
So this huge reserve of kelp, which I've never seen before, and I'm not sure if you've ever seen kelp, but it's like kind of very long, almost dreadlocky type strands of seaweed, but they're thick. You know, as thick as like a I don't know, a fillet, you know, and they're kind of waving around in the water, where if you look at it, so you're coming down, we've got like these goggles on, if you look at it, it's just mesmeric the way it moves around with the currents.
Is it edible, Coibs?
I don't think it is. No, it's quite hardcore.
Right.
It's not the edible seaweed that you get in sushi, if that's what you're thinking of. But it's just beautiful, and there's like fish that kind of live within it and hide in it, and Yeah, and it's gorgeous. And Paula was saying that it's a sign of a very clean ocean. Or like if you've got healthy kelp forests, mm-hmm. then it's really good for the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're just absolutely beautiful beaches. Really, really like stunning. And much less talked about, much less touched than, for example, the Balearic Islands.
I was going to ask you about other tourists. Are there tourists up there, and where are they from? Are they foreign, or are they from other parts of Spain? I mean, there are people there. You intimated that when you got there 10 days ago, there was no one, but now there are people.
Yeah. So what I think is the most common thing is that people from other parts of Spain have houses here. So they'll come and do their summer holidays up in Galicia or around the area of Galicia. And Asturias is quite good for that as well. But mainly what you get is Gallegos coming back here for the summertime. So there's not, but we haven't seen any English people. We haven't seen any Germans. You know, there's the classic Costa del Sol tourism you'd find. It's generally Galicians coming back to the pueblos during the summer breaks.
And I know you want to get on, Koibi, but I just want to ask you about the food, because I know that features quite highly in your list of priorities. How's that been?
The food is
fishy,
a
I imagine.
Break from living in Sevilla, to be honest. I'm wondering why I do live in Sevilla these days. the food is incredible. We've had some very good seafood, some very, very good seafood. Big fat juicy scallops, almejas, mussels like you wouldn't believe. Like if you go to any wild beach here, the rocks, like some of the rocks will be covered in these black patches, and you go move a little bit closer and you realize it's just a forest of mussels, which you don't pick. Then no one picks them and eats them, because there's then within the Rías, which is like a very tranquil like water, in the center of the Rías you find all these mussel farms. So these kind of floating pontoons with large kind of poles that go down into the ocean, and they're all full of these really fat juicy mussels. So the beach ones, the wild ones, aren't actually touched, and I'm pretty sure they're protected. And then, so that's the seafood part of it. And then the other thing that Gallegos are also obviously famous for is their beef, and they create some absolutely delicious beef. Chuletons, which are with thick bones and very, very hot brasa. So very hot kind of barbecue coals, and they'll be seared on these barbecue coals and then kind of cut off the bone and just... If you get one that's properly aged, that's been aged for like a good few days, I think the minimum kind of standard requirement for being Galician is around 90 days, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And the taste of this meat is incredible, you know. I mean, I think you get a lot of beef these days, which is good and it's nice, and the standard of beef generally is high. But here, it's a long time since I've had a piece of beef that actually makes you stop and think, you know.
Stop and think of what?
Just of how delicious it is.
The cow.
Normally,
the unfortunate cow.
When was the last time you ate a piece of beef and you actually
had to stop?
Wow, that is. Yeah, that is a delicious taste.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a really, really good food.
Good, right.
And it's not only beaches as well. The whole place, the whole coast is surrounded by giant forests. So you've got pine forests, you've got a lot of eucalypt, you've got oaks, and there's some beautiful walks which you can do up river valleys, and you'll find these natural waterfalls, which are kind of very, very common actually. So you can find them everywhere. And there is one thing about the eucalypts, for example. My father-in-law is Gallego, and he complained about the eucalypts because they're not an autochthonous species.
Too right.
And they are taking over. And apparently, I'm not sure you could confirm this, apparently they're not good for the soil.
No.
They don't regenerate the soil very well.
No, they chew, but they suck on the soil, they alter the pH, they don't tolerate any growth of other species beneath them. It's a hideous monoculture.
Right. Yeah, well, you get a lot. I'm actually looking out over a eucalypt forest as we speak.
Yeah. No, they need controlling. It's the big pulp companies from Sweden and Portugal, I think. Anyway, listen, man. I'm talking of forests and mussels. I know you want to get back to your CrossFit, so I'm going to let you go. And thank you very much for your time this morning. I think we'll stop there, because otherwise everyone will be heading up to Galicia, and then it will be dreadful. It'll be like here.
Did I say Galicia? I didn't know. No, I meant Valencia. I'm in Valencia.
Ah, you're in Valencia. Ah, of course.
Yeah. Everyone go to Valencia.
All right. Just where
Galicia's
is...
Galicia's awful.
Where is he? Was that a postcard from Valencia? Or was it, in fact, from Galicia? Kobe, thanks very much, man. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. Happy 4th of July.
Yeah. Bye-bye now. That's Coy talking to us from an undisclosed destination. Was it Valencia or was it Galicia? We're going to listen to some advertisements now, and then I'm going to be back with some stories of the Spanish Civil War. Welcome back. July 2026. This month sees not only the uber-hyped 250th anniversary of the American Declaration of Independence, but more pertinently for us living here in Spain, I feel, the 90th anniversary of the Spanish Civil War. Within the turbulent story of Spain's 20th century, a convulsion that was both pivotal and, as Jan Morris explains, somehow inevitable. What a mess of a country, addled by, she writes, addled by bitter politics at home. Between 1814 and 1923, there were 43 coups d'etat. Embroiled in constant wars in the pathetic remnants of her empire, now confined to a few sandy or fetid enclaves in Africa, diplomatically a cipher, strategically so inessential that the First World War contemptuously passed her by, conflicting ideologies tortured her, dogmas of monarchy, theocracy, despotism, democracy, socialism, anarchism, communism, her rural poverty and urban squalor periodically erupted into violence. Her colonial policies were so inept that in 1921 her Moroccan army was annihilated in the Rif. A dictator, Primo de Rivera, came and went. In 1931, the last of the monarchy, the Bourbons, bowed out in the chaos, giving way to a left-wing republic. And in 1936, all these centuries of failure, schism, and frustration gave birth to that ultimate despair, the Spanish Civil War, which broke out this month in July of 1936. And although it came to involve foreign powers in a prelude to the Second World War, its origins were endemic to Spain. On the What began as a military rising developed into a much wider conflict, summarised by Gerald Brennan in The Spanish Labyrinth. The military junta and a group of right-wing politicians which rose against the government, he says, expected to occupy the whole of Spain, except Barcelona and perhaps Madrid, within a few days. They had at their disposal the greater part of the armed forces of the country, the Civil Guard, the Foreign Legion, a division of Moorish troops from Spain, from Spanish Morocco, rather, four-fifths of the infantry and artillery officers, and a certain number of regiments recruited in the north and therefore reliable. The promise of Italian and German tanks and aeroplanes, if necessary. Against these, the government had only the Republican assault guards and a small, badly armed air force. But the plans of the rebels, that's the military lot, that's Franco's lot, they were defeated or at least postponed by the tremendous courage and enthusiasm with which the people rose to defend themselves and by the loyalty of the naval ratings, who at a critical moment deprived Franco of command of the sea, each side being then left in control of one half of Spain. The civil war became inevitable. The opening act of General Franco's participation in the military rising, his flight from the Canaries to Spanish Morocco, which was a covert affair, and when he arrived in Spanish Morocco, he rallied his troops. This particular flight has been described in terms that transform him into the great crusader of Spanish mythology. Louis Bolin, a right-wing journalist who accompanied Franco on his flight to history on board a light aircraft operated oddly by an English pilot called Captain Begg. Bolin writes in Spain, The Vital Years, "Dawn was breaking when we reached the airport where Muchininho, an Algerian who run it, was already bustling around. The gates of the hangar slid heavily on their metal wheels. We saw the aeroplane, Le Dragon Rapide, itching like a falcon for the air. We pushed it outside. It took Captain Begg only a moment to get the propellers spinning. Our plane rose quickly over the ground and departed without leaving any trace of Casablanca." Franco was silent now, and hardly a word passed between the rest of us. We'd been on our way for about an hour when the general, reckoning that we were over the Spanish protectorate, opened his suitcase, discarded the dark grey suit in which he had travelled from the Canaries, and changed into his khaki uniform. A lump rose in my throat when I saw him wind around his waist the scarlet gold tasseled sash, which in the Spanish army constitutes the most distinctive symbol of a general's rank. This was it. In his usual quiet and unassuming manner, Franco had attired himself to take command of the forces that awaited his arrival, and years were to elapse ere he donned civilian clothes again. It was in Andalusia that the first of the military risings occurred in response to General Franco's call to arms. Among those residing in Andalusia at the time were Gerald Brennan and his wife, the American Gamal Woolsey. They had only recently moved to Churiana near Malaga. The surprise and excitement of the first hours of the Civil War were described by Gamal in her autobiographical novel, Death's Other Kingdom. She says, "I started awake. Maria was standing at the foot of the bed. 'Why are you sleeping?' she said, 'when Malaga is burning down.' I leapt out of bed asking, 'What's happened? What is it?' Still half asleep. 'There's been a rising,' she said, 'and they've set fire to the city.' We rushed to the window. Malaga was lying spread out across the bay underneath a pall of smoke. The city was hidden and the smoke drifted far out over the sea. Malaga burning down. 'But what's happened?' we kept asking, and no one could tell us. Lorries full of armed workmen began to appear, rushing down the road, and as they passed, they threw up their left arms in the popular front salute, the clenched left fist and bent arm. With the pistols in their right hands, loaded and cocked and ready to go off, they waved to us gaily. 'Someone will get killed soon,' said Enrique sardonically, 'and it won't be a fascist. It'll be one of us if we don't stay indoors.' No Spanish town was to be saved the trauma of the Civil War. Granada became the setting for an early and bloody battle between opposing factions. The governor was urged by the Republican government in Madrid to resist the military rising. Among those in the town at the time was Helen Nicholson, Baroness Linitsky. Her daughter, Asta, with whom she was staying, was married to a Spaniard and lived in a house situated on the Alhambra Hill. In the garden were magnolia trees, and in July the air was heavy with the perfume of the great white waxen blossoms. This idyll was wrecked when the working-class quarter of the Albaicin, directly beneath the Alhambra, became the scene of bloody street fighting with innumerable casualties as troops loyal to Franco moved in to crush the popular resistance. Nicholson watched from a distance, her worry being that all of us who are not communists might be massacred at any moment. In her memoirs, Death in the Morning, she records, "I was conscious of the unnatural stillness that hung over the Alhambra. It was about 6 o'clock, And ordinarily, at that hour, there were abundant sounds of life from the road and from an open-air cafe nearby. Guitar music, snatches of song, women's laughter, children's cries and men's deeper voices. But now that our dogs, Nita and Teddy, had ceased barking, there was utter silence. It was so abnormal that I felt uneasy. And at that moment, I heard the sharp crack of rifle shots from the Plaza Nueva. The shots lasted only a few moments, and Kathleen, my English maid, coming in with my tea on a tray, declared that she'd heard nothing. Downstairs in the kitchen, she explained, with the Spanish servants all chattering together and the fountain in the patio making so much noise. It was hard to hear anything else. But while she arranged the tea things on a table, I walked up and down, and in my bedroom and my sitting room adjoining it, I have to say those were among the worst moments I've ever spent. The Republican government failed to oppose the military rising with constitutional means. The bulk of the forces of law and order joined the Franco's side, and an attempt to use loyal members of the Navy to mount a counter-offensive proved short-lived. In towns where there were no garrisons loyal to Franco, trades unionists and left-wing activists took the law into their own hands and opted for revolution. Hugh Thomas, in his masterly book, The Spanish Civil War, described the climate of political turmoil that gripped Spain. So now there was to spread over Spain a cloud of violence in which the quarrels of several generations would find outlet. With communications difficult or non-existent, each town would find itself on its own, acting out its own drama in an apparent vacuum. There were soon not to be two Spains, but 2,000. The geographical differences within Spain were a prime factor in the social disintegration of the country. Regional feeling had sown the wind and now reaped the whirlwind. Sovereign power ceased to exist, and in its absence, individuals as well as towns acted without constraint, as if they were outside society and history. Within a month, thousands of people would have perished arbitrarily and without trial. Bishops would be murdered and churches profaned. Educated Christians would spend their evenings murdering illiterate peasants and professional men of sensitivity. These events inevitably caused such hatreds that when order was eventually established, it was an order geared solely for the realization of hatred known as war. Among the Spanish writers, José María Gironella stands out for having attempted to portray objectively the events preceding the Civil War and its impact on Spanish society. In his novel, The Cypresses Believe in God, Gironella focused on what he considered a constant of the Spanish character, the tendency towards the instinctive, the individualistic, the anarchic. Spaniards follow men, he wrote in the introduction, better than they follow ideas. This accounts for the inclemency of personal relationships, the small respect for laws, and this, too, is what causes our periodic civil convulsions. It is the Spanish character thus defined rather than any idea or political dogma that informs this description by Gironella of the first executions in July 1936 in the town of Girona. As in the rest of Catalonia, power here was retained for much of the civil war by the left. Gironella says, "Half of the city learned during the night what was going on. The neighbours of those who were taken from their homes, those who peered fearfully out of their windows when they heard the cars stop, those who heard the screams of the victims on the stairs, those who sensed something strange and menacing in the slamming of the doors, those who, without stirring from bed, recognized in the steps on the sidewalk something hard and belligerent from which there was no appeal. And just across the waters of the Mediterranean on the Balearic Islands, it was the nationalists who imposed control from an early stage. And their particular brand of terror, repeated in many parts of the mainland, was recorded by the French Catholic writer Georges Bernanos in Les Grands Cimetières sous la Lune. At first, Bernanos was sympathetic to the nationalist cause. He was actually staying at the time in the home of a leading local phalangist and believed that the rebellious generals would assume the moral and religious unity of the country. But Bernanos became increasingly horrified with the summary executions carried out on left-wing sympathizers, with very often the complicity and on many occasions of priests and bishops. I've seen with my own eyes, I tell you, he says, a small Christian people with peaceful traditions, extremely, almost absurdly friendly. I've seen them turn suddenly to stone, seen their faces hardening, even their children's faces. For months in Mallorca, killer gangs swiftly transported from village to village in lorries, requisitioned for the purpose, shot down in cold blood for everybody to see. Thousands of persons who were held to be suspect, but against whom the military tribunal itself could not produce the faintest legal allegation. Few wars in modern times have stirred political conscience and fired literary imagination as much as the Spanish Civil War. Spain, in the period of 1936 to 1939, became not so much a country at war with itself as a stage on which a wider ideological and religious struggle was played out by men of many nationalities. The poet Miguel Hernández was a shepherd who joined the communist 5th Regiment militia and defended Madrid from strongholds in the surrounding sierras against attacks by land and air from the Franco's forces. He drew his images of freedom from the fighters of Spain, as in this, one of his most famous verses, "The Winds of the People." The winds of the people sustain me, spreading within my heart. The winds of the people impel me and roar in my very throat. I come not from a people of oxen. My people's praise, the lion's leap, the eagle's straight swoop, and the strong charge of the bull whose pride is in his horns. And that is a little tribute to the beginning of the Spanish Civil War some 90 years ago. And this is a song by Yasmin Levy, and it's called Nací en Alamo. Hi, welcome back. Williamo, nice to hear from you, man. He says that the food is amazing in Galicia. And when he was there a year ago, the weather was actually quite cool. But I guess it's getting hotter all the time, isn't it? As demonstrated by the amount of traffic that we've got on the roads, if not hopelessly lost, then at least confused. Look out, tourists are about in hire cars. And few places demonstrate the silliness of summer better than the roads, in particular the singular carretera, namely the tarmac artery, linking Catalonia with Huelva, our lifeline, the N340. For most of the year, a necessary hazard undertaken by us all, which in July and August morphs into a mix of lethal Game Boy, hot hatch and supercar antics. punctuated during the heat miraging day in accidents and kilometres of gridlock. You might be sitting in one now. This week alone, I've been becalmed like a static processionary caterpillar in shimmering horizon-piercing queues for hours at a time. Of course, people in Northern Europe spend significant epochs of their lives sat in traffic, but outside of July and August, we're not used to this. I mean, right now, though, it's mega volume, and it's mostly on the old Carretera because the autopista, the peage, is outrageously expensive. Of course, all the prices go up in summer. But what interests me about the roads at this time of year is that they illustrate perfectly the essential rhythmic disconnect between tourist and holidaymaker. The tourist holidaymaker, rather, and those of us who live here and are trying to make a living. So you've got these two kind of classes of people trying to use the road. Some people are sort of doing the everyday stuff, and other people are just literally bimbling about. So, and within this traffic saturation, it's worth identifying who your fellow road users actually are. Meet the Moroccans who have just started to arrive. Caravans of migrating Mercedes swaying unsteadily under roof racks stacked with kitchen appliances and bicycle frames. I mean, that's the stereotype. Actually, nowadays, a lot of the Moroccans come down in quite nice cars with, you know, hatchbacks. But it's the great summer migration from Rotterdam to Tetuan, from Paris to Casablanca. These guys know exactly where they're headed. Oh, look out, coming up on your inside lane in something of a frenzy. Say hello to the Carretera Regular. It's multi-drop delivery white van man. Stay out of his way. No time for napping. He's got his Red Bull wings flapping. He knows exactly where he's going. More sedately coping with the backwash of one too many gin and tonics, there are the residents in SUVs popping to Mercadona. Sozzled they may be, but they know where they're going, as do the semi-trailer container bucanero camioneros. They plough a relentless fast lane furrow. They're barreling their way from Algeciras to Alicante and back again. They know where they're going. Buzzing between the juggernauts are swarms of worker bees in ubiquitous berlingos. They know exactly where they're going. And by way of contrast, the remaining 20% of the vehicles on the Carretera, those that have stickers on them saying Malaga car or Hertz or Eurocar, they've no idea where they're going. In defiance of logic, if they're indicating right, there's a higher than evens chance that they'll swerve to the left. In defiance of common sense, prone to stopping without warning, but particularly on roundabouts, the holiday hire cars bimble along with only a shadowy grasp of the very basic tenet of a journey, the idea that you are going from A to B. A week ago on Monday, I came across the static aftermath of a low-impact collision on a roundabout in Guadamina. Nothing unusual about the backup of queuing cars congesting the slip road exit from the Carretera, nor the gaggle of a benign group of obvious tourists standing about on mobiles in the sunshine at the scene of the accident. Well, it wasn't really an accident. Make it an incident, because the protagonist showed no signs of shell shock, trauma, cuts or bruises. There was no twisted metal or bits of car lying about. And nor were the police interfering in the discernible mood of bonhomie and bravado because they weren't there. The two hire cars were skewed very slightly, not quite touching, blocking one lane of the roundabout. But and this is what was unusual. Both the vehicles were facing the wrong way, which meant that because they very obviously hadn't been slaloming like boy racers spinning 180 degrees, leaving licorice slicks of rubber patterned on the tarmac. Both drivers, instead of turning right onto the roundabout to circumnavigate it anti-clockwise, they had decided to turn left. In fact, there was almost certainly no conscious decision here. One car was following the other. It would appear that the lead driver had instinctively turned left, as you do back in Blighty. All good until you meet the astonished oncoming traffic who are circulating anti-clockwise. In the face of not just one, but two carloads of oncoming tourists. I mean, let's not get too smug. I actually have driven around a roundabout the wrong way here in Spain. I mean, maybe you have too. What do you do if you're driving round the roundabout the wrong way? Well, there's two courses of evasive action immediately that present themselves. One, you hit the curb and stop, as these guys had done, and hope that a large hole will open up and swallow you to alleviate your embarrassment. Or the other possible manoeuvre I remember executing myself in a Volkswagen Polo with my elderly mother somewhere in near Girona. Must have been back in the late 80s. And we vacated the roundabout with as little disruption as possible by the most suitable exit, applying the accelerator. My mum hadn't actually noticed the swerving, the blaring of horns of approaching nemesis. When I said to her, "Ma, have you ever been round a roundabout the wrong way?" And she said something like, "Oh, goodness, darling," as we bailed out of an exit, horn blaring, lights on, with an anxious eye in the rear vision for a resultant roundabout carnage or even the police. While we're talking about traffic over in Russia, you may have heard about fuel shortages there due to Ukraine's successful campaign of droning refineries. Well, 82 out of 83 of Russia's recognized regions are now apparently affected. The sole area that isn't affected is an area in Siberia called Chukotka, where apparently reindeer outnumber people by 4 to 1. But make no mistake, this is an energy superpower struggling with a lack of energy across 11 of its time zones. The result? Price hikes, queues, queue brawls, jump the queue black markets, and a surging demand for bicycles. And over in far eastern Irkutsk, the queuing at the pumps is so prolonged that the mayor has just announced he will install porta-potties along the growing lineups of exasperated motorists. So that's a good thing if you're queuing for fuel over there in Irkutsk. And you might remember Janie and I talking about shorts last week, and I came across this article by Leo Lewis in the Financial Times last weekend. "Short wearers of the world unite," he says. "There are FT colleagues in London, New York and Brussels who will shudder at this disclosure, but 66% of the three men in the Tokyo Bureau..." 66% of the three men in the Tokyo Bureau, that means three of the three men. 66% of the three men in the Tokyo Bureau are currently wearing shorts in the office, in meetings, in bare need professionalism. I don't quite get his stat, but the idea is that shorts are becoming de rigueur in even somewhere as formal as Tokyo. The existence of one office holdout is important. His perseverance serves as a reminder that the brainwashing powers of the tribes occult remain strong, and incredibly, that the shorts debate is far from settled. That is possibility. That is possibly because the pro-shorts lobby has historically done such a poor job of championing the male lower leg. Better branding would help. We're not shorts wearers for a start, but shin maxers, says Leo Lewis, citizen of nowhere. Last week we were talking about short shorts and how you can cut them off too short and how as a man you really don't want to be wearing hot pants. Finally, a word on gazpacho, making gazpacho. I mean, I love gazpacho, and you're probably drinking gazpacho at this time of year. But sometimes life gets in the way of actually making it. And El País got chef Rafa de Bedoya to blind taste 10 brands. I'm not going to bore you with a league table, except to say that the Lidl's brand of gazpacho is apparently the tastiest. And on that bombshell, I'm going to bid you a very happy weekend and look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.